Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and Phil Dierking. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Ashley tells us this story.
U.S. President Donald Trump told Palestinian and Jordanian leaders on Tuesday that he intends to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. A Palestinian spokesman said Trump called Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and informed him of his plan. Abbas then warned Trump of what he called the dangerous consequences such a decision would have to the peace process and to the peace, security, and stability of the region and of the world. Trump also spoke with Jordan's King Abdullah II about his plan. Trump has not said when the move would happen. U.S. officials told the Associated Press that they expect Trump to discuss the question of Jerusalem on Wednesday. The officials also said they expect him to make a statement about Jerusalem's status as the capital of Israel. However, they do not expect the president to use the term undivided capital. Those words indirectly express that Israel has sovereignty over East Jerusalem, which is not recognized by the United Nations. Jerusalem is home to important holy sites for Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. It forms the center of the Arab-Israel conflict. Israel captured the Arab section in East Jerusalem during the Six-Day War in 1967. It then declared the whole city as its capital. The move is not recognized internationally. Palestinians also want Jerusalem as its future capital. Under international agreement and long-standing U.S. policy, the fate of Jerusalem is to be decided in Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. A recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital would greatly change the traditional approach to the Middle East conflict. On Tuesday, warnings against such a move by the U.S. came from leaders across the region. In Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said during a meeting of his ruling party, "Mr. Trump, Jerusalem is the red line of Muslims." A red line is the limit beyond which someone should not go without facing severe effects. Erdogan added that those effects could include cutting Turkey's ties with Israel. "I am warning the United States not to take such a step, which will deepen the problems in the region," Erdogan said. A Palestinian diplomat said recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital could destroy the United States' role as mediator between Israelis and Palestinians. The diplomat, Majdi Khaldi, told the Associated Press, "If the Americans recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, then this would mean they decided on their own to distance themselves from efforts to make peace, and that they will have no credibility or role in this issue." He added that, we will stop our contacts with them because such a step goes against our existence and against the fate of our cause. Saudi Arabia's foreign ministry warned that such a move would provoke strong feelings among Muslims around the world. Israeli Education Minister Naftali Bennett played down the threat of violence, saying, "At the end of the day, it is better to have a united Jerusalem than Erdogan's sympathy." But Daniel Benjamin, a former U.S. counterterrorism official, told Reuters news agency, "This is playing with fire."
If you are interested in studying at an American college or university, you have probably heard about the test of English as a foreign language. The test is widely known as the TOEFL. It is the most widely used language assessment exam for American colleges. A TOEFL score may be necessary to get a student visa to an English-speaking country. Some businesses and even government offices use the test scores to measure the English language abilities of their employees. Many foreign students worry about taking the TOEFL because it is important to meeting their goals. Good marks on the test will open many doors, but a low test score will limit your choices for financial aid and admission to top schools. The most competitive universities generally expect an internet-based test, or IBT, score of 90 or above. Others accept lower scores, and some do not require students to take the TOEFL at all. Most universities do not publicize an actual cutoff score, but a high mark will always help. Many students study for the TOEFL test before they are ready. You should have completed at least upper intermediate level English classes before you take the test. If you scored below 70 on the IBT or 500 on the paper-based test, or PBT, it is wise to continue studying for a few months and come back to the TOEFL later.
Let's take a closer look at the two major versions of the TOEFL. The IBT is offered in most of the world and accepted by nearly every college and university, as well as scholarship program in the United States. The PBT is given in places where the internet is not widely available. The content of the PBT was changed in 2017. As a result, its line of questioning is now similar to that of the IBT. Both the IBT and PBT have integrated tasks. That means questions involving listening, reading, and writing are mixed together. The revised PBT costs less, around US$180, than the IBT. However, costs can differ from country to country. $215 in Brazil, $245 in France. The PBT has three areas, reading, listening, and writing, and takes 2 hours and 50 minutes to complete. The IBT has four parts, reading, listening, speaking, and writing. Including time spent on registration, the IBT test lasts 4.5 hours. Test takers spend 20 minutes answering 6 questions involving speech. Each question requires first reading or listening to English examples, then expressing one's opinion by speaking. If you have a choice, take the IBT, unless you are trying to cut down on costs. Plan when you will take the TOEFL. If possible, register to take the test, even if the date is several months from now. This will give you a good reason to study. Take a sample test online or from a test preparation book to find out where you need to improve the most. Do you do well in reading, but not so well in listening? This will help you to plan your studies to develop the skills you need to get a better score.
The Educational Testing Service, or ETS, website has a free online course to help you prepare for the TOEFL. There are also sample preparation questions and games on the ETS Facebook page, like the 40-word challenge. You can buy books with a guide to the test and sample questions from ETS or other publishers. In addition to answering those questions, try to surround yourself with English. Listen every day to podcasts or stories on VOA's Learning English website. Try taking notes on what you hear. Watch movies where English is spoken, and listen to music with English lyrics. Read English language newspapers to keep up with new words that relate to current events and technology. Experts say that you should study for at least 2 months before taking the test. But if your practice test score is more than 20 points below your goal, you may need to improve your overall English ability, and that may take years. To get a good score, you need to set aside time to study, set goals, and measure your progress. Think of it as a school where you are the top administrator. As the chief, you can decide your plan of action. I will practice the listening section every night this week. Then I will take a listening sample test. If I am happy with my score, I will practice the speaking section every night next week. Be sure you build in rewards for improving your score, like taking a weekend off from study.
Did you know that TOEFL has a search service? It can help connect you with colleges, universities, and other educational institutions, as well as postgraduate programs. TOEFL will send you information about other study programs, admissions requirements, financial aid, fellowships, and other educational opportunities. Choose the search service when you create or change your registration. You can also find out which schools will accept the TOEFL score you earned on the ETS website. There are other large-scale testing programs to measure one's English ability. You may need to take another test to meet the rules for immigration or studying overseas, so look around to find out the requirements. And don't waste time studying for the TOEFL if you will not attend school or go overseas in the next 2 years. Remember, colleges will only accept the test score for up to 2 years.
The bottom line is, the best way to do well on the TOEFL is to know English well. Do not depend on informal advice or tricks. Do not try to outwit the test maker. Think of reading, listening, speaking, writing, and grammar as a single connected idea, communication. The real goal of the test is to measure how well a student can communicate in an English-speaking classroom. Immerse yourself in English on a daily basis, and improvement is sure to follow. I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, the leaders wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we told how the group reached agreement on the position and powers of a national executive. They decided the executive could veto laws, and they decided the person could be removed from office if found guilty of serious crimes. We also told about the debate on a national judiciary. The delegates approved a federal system of courts and judges. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the country. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. Next, the delegates began to discuss competing proposals for a national legislature. This would be the most hotly debated issue of the convention. It forced the question of equal representation. Would small states and large states have an equal voice in the central government? The convention had already agreed that the national legislature would have two houses. It had not agreed, however, on the number of representatives each state would have in each house. The large states wanted representation based on population, but the small states believed they would lose power to the large states. They wanted representation to be the same for all states, no matter what the size. One day, Gunning Bedford of Delaware, one of the smallest states, looked straight at the delegates from the largest states. "Gentlemen," he shouted, "I do not trust you. If you try to crush the small states, you will destroy the Confederation. And if you do, the small states will find some foreign ally of more honor and good faith who will take them by the hand and give them justice." The debate on legislative representation, big states against small states, lasted for weeks that summer in Philadelphia. The delegates could not agree, so they debated other parts of the proposal. One involved the names of the two houses of the legislature. Most spoke of them simply as the first branch and the second branch. We will speak of them by the names used today, the House of Representatives and the Senate. Next came the question, who could be elected to the House and Senate? Delegates did not take long to decide. Members of the House, they agreed, must be at least 25 years old. They must have been citizens of the United States for 7 years. And at the time of election, they must live in the state in which they are chosen. The delegates agreed that members of the Senate must be at least 30 years old. They also must have been a citizen of the United States for 9 years. And at the time of election, they too must live in the state in which they are chosen. But who would elect them? The question raised an interesting issue. It concerned democracy. In 1787, the word democracy meant something very different from what it means today. To many of the men meeting in Philadelphia, democracy meant mob rule. To give power to the people was an invitation to anarchy. Still, George Mason of Virginia argued for popular elections. The people will be represented, Mason said, so they should choose their representatives. James Wilson of Pennsylvania agreed. He stated firmly that the people must elect at least one branch of the national legislature. That, he said, was a basic condition for free government. The majority of the convention agreed with Mason. The delegates decided that members of the House of Representatives should be elected directly by the people. Akhil Reed Amar is a professor at Yale Law School in Connecticut. He says the delegates' decision to let people elect their representatives helped change the meaning of the word democracy.
The success of the American Constitutional Project has proved to the rest of the world that democracy can work, government of, by, and for the people can survive and flourish, and this has been a model for the rest of the world.
However, most delegates agreed that the state legislatures would choose the representatives to the second legislative branch, the Senate. It remained that way for more than 100 years. In 1913, the states approved the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. This amendment legalized the direct election of senators by the people. How long would lawmakers serve? Roger Sherman of Connecticut thought representatives to the House should be elected every year. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts agreed. He thought a longer term would lead to a dictatorship. James Madison of Virginia protested. It will take almost 1 year, he said, just for lawmakers to travel to and from the seat of government. Madison proposed a 3-year term, but the delegates finally agreed on 2 years. There were many ideas about the term for senators. A few delegates thought they should be elected for life. In the end, the convention agreed on a Senate term of 6 years. Next came a debate about the pay for elected officials. How much should they get? Or should they be paid at all? Some delegates thought the states should pay their representatives to the national legislature. Others said the national legislature should decide its own pay and take it from the national treasury. That idea, James Madison argued, was shameful. He thought the amount should be set by the Constitution. Again, Madison lost the argument. The Constitution states only that lawmakers will be paid for their services and that the money will come from the national treasury. Finally, the time came for the convention to face the issue of representation in the House and Senate. The large states still wanted representation based on population, and the small states still wanted equal representation. The delegates had voted on the issue several times since the convention began. But both sides stood firm. Yet they knew they could not continue to vote forever, day after day. So the delegates did what large groups often do when they cannot reach agreement. They voted to create a committee. This grand committee would try to develop a compromise. The rest of the delegates would enjoy themselves during the July 4th holiday marking American independence. July 4th, Independence Day. It marked the 11th anniversary of America's Declaration of Independence from British rule. The celebration was especially important in Philadelphia. It was the city where the Declaration of Independence was signed. Now it was the city where a new nation was being created. Convention President George Washington led a group of delegates to a ceremony at a Philadelphia church. They heard a speech written especially for them. "Your country looks to you with both worry and hope," the speaker said. "Your country depends on your decisions. Your country believes that men such as you, who led us in our war for independence, will know how to plan a government that will be good for all Americans. Surely we have the ability to design a government that will protect the liberties we have won." After the speech, Benjamin Franklin urged the convention to ask for God's help. He said each meeting should begin with a prayer. Hugh Williamson of North Carolina quickly ended any discussion of Franklin's idea. The convention, he said, had no money to pay a minister to lead the delegates in prayer. On July 5th, the Grand Committee presented a two-part compromise. It provided something for large states and something for small states. It called for representation based on population in the House and for equal representation in the Senate. The committee said both parts of the compromise must be accepted or both rejected. Delegates debated the compromise for many days. They knew if they did not reach agreement, the convention would fail. Those were dark days in Philadelphia. Later, Luther Martin of Maryland noted that the newspapers reported on how much the delegates agreed. But that was not the truth. "We were on the edge of breaking up," Martin said. "We were held together only by the strength of a hair." Delegates Robert Yates and John Lansing of New York had left the convention in protest. But George Mason of Virginia declared he would bury his bones in Philadelphia before he would leave without an agreement. Even General George Washington was depressed. He wrote to Alexander Hamilton, who had returned to New York temporarily. "I am sorry you went away," Washington said. "Our discussions are now, if possible, worse than ever. There is little agreement on which a good government can be formed. I have lost almost all hope of seeing a successful end to the convention, and so I regret that I agreed to take part." On July 16th, the convention voted on the issue for the last time. It accepted what is called the Great Compromise. But even this agreement raised another problem. If representation was based on population, who would you count? Would you count just free people? Or would you count Negro slaves too?
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.